Good evening. A House committee grills Attorney General Bill Barr. An investigation into Trump's Lafayette Park photo op.
As the late Representative John Lewis said, when you see something that is not right, not just, not fair, you have a moral obligation to say something.
And a civil rights icon, John Lewis, is honored in the Capitol Rotunda. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the news for Tuesday, July 28th, 2020. Flag-draped coffin of United States Representative John Lewis was escorted to the Capitol, where it will lie in state through tomorrow, the first time a black lawmaker was granted the honor. The coffin was supported by the same ceremonial box where the body of Abraham Lincoln lay in 1865. He rose from an Alabama farmhouse without running water or electricity to become a leader in the civil rights movement and enter the halls of Congress. The crowds that would have flocked to the ceremony were limited by the coronavirus to about 100, a cross-section from both parties, and many wore masks emblazoned with the words, "Good Trouble," from his commencement address at Emory University, imploring students, "Find a way to get into trouble, good trouble. Necessary trouble." Lewis, a 17-term congressman, was a senior member of the Congressional Black Caucus. He died July 17th after battling pancreatic cancer. He was known as the conscience of the Congress for his moral authority acquired through years of protest for racial equality. And the Washington Post ran a story of interest today, a profile of 88-year-old Washington, D.C. resident Daniel Smith, one of the last living persons with a parent who was a slave. Smith's father, Abram Smith, married a woman who was decades younger and fathered six children. Dan, the fifth, was born in 1932. A foot soldier in the civil rights movement, when asked about his unique place in history, Smith responded, "Quite frankly, I've just grown up and been busy, and I've never thought much about it." After the killing of George Floyd on May 25th, Smith drove himself downtown to check out the protests as his wife waved a sign reading, "Black and White Lives Together." But in the chambers of the House Judiciary Committee, the atmosphere was anything but united. Chairman Jerry Nadler and Attorney General Bill Barr quickly clashed during a highly anticipated hearing over whether the Department of Justice is being used to punish President Trump's enemies.
In connection with your discussions with the president or with other people around him of his reelection campaign, have you discussed the current or future deployment of federal law enforcement?
Well, as I say, I'm not going to get into my discussions with the president, but I've made it clear that I would like to pick the cities based on law enforcement need and based on neutral criteria.
But you can't tell me whether you discussed...
No, I'm not going to discuss what I discussed with the president.
Can you commit today that the department will not use federal law enforcement as a prop in the president's reelection campaign?
We are not using federal law enforcement.
I just want to close with this thought. You really can't hide behind legal fictions this time, Mr. Barr. It's all out in the open, where the people can see what you are doing for themselves. The president wants footage for his campaign ads, and you appear to be serving it up to him as ordered. In most of these cities, the protests had begun to wind down before you marched in and confronted the protesters. And the protesters aren't mobs. They are mothers and veterans and mayors. In this moment, real leadership would entail de-escalation, collaboration, and looking for ways to peaceably resolve our differences. Instead, you use pepper spray and truncheons on American citizens. You did it here in Washington, you did it at Lafayette Square, you expanded to Portland, and now you are projecting fear and violence nationwide in pursuit of obvious political objectives. Shame on you, Mr. Barr.
Can I just say, Mr.
Shame on you.
Can I just
My
say,
time has expired.
I just reject the idea that the department has flooded anywhere and attempted to suppress demonstrators. We make a clear distinction between demonstrators.
The facts speak
well,
for themselves.
This
is my time,
I'm answering,
Chairman.
And you know, the fact of the matter is, if you take Portland, the courthouse is under attack. the federal resources are inside the perimeter around the courthouse defending it from almost 2 months of daily attacks where people march to the court, try to gain entrance, and have set fires, thrown things, used explosives. We are on the defense. We're not out looking for trouble. And if the state and the city would provide the law enforcement services that other jurisdictions do, we would have no need to have additional marshals in the courthouse.
Attorney General William Barr sparring with Judiciary Committee Chair Gerald Nadler earlier today. Across the way from the Judiciary Committee was the House Natural Resources Committee, where a hearing into the president's June 1st photo op during a police action against peaceful protesters in Lafayette Park across from the White House occurred. More than half an hour before a 6 p.m. curfew, federal agents unleashed pepper balls and clubs against thousands protesting the killing of George Floyd by a cop in Minneapolis several days earlier. Famously, Trump hoisted a Bible before the church that had been damaged in protests the night before. A major in the D.C. National Guard, Adam DeMarco, testified there was no reason to assault the crowd, that the stated reason, building a fence to protect the White House, couldn't have been true, because there was no fence until 9 p.m.
At around 6:20 p.m., the Park Police issued the first of three warning announcements to the demonstrators, directing them to disperse. I did not expect the announcement so early, as the D.C. curfew was not to go into effect until 7 p.m. that evening. 40 minutes later. The warnings were conveyed using a megaphone near the statue of President Andrew Jackson, approximately 50 yards from the demonstrators. From where I was standing, approximately 20 yards from the demonstrators, the announcements were barely audible, and I saw no indication that the demonstrators were cognizant of the warnings to disperse. At approximately 6:30 p.m., the Park Police began the clearing operation led by the civil disturbance units and horse-mounted officers. No National Guard personnel participated in the push or engaged in any other use of force against the demonstrators. I saw demonstrators scattering and fleeing as Park Police charged towards them. I observed people fall to the ground and some Park Police use their shields offensively as weapons. As I walked behind Park Police pushing westward on 8th Street, I also observed unidentified law enforcement personnel behind our National Guardsmen using paintball-like weapons to discharge what I later learned to be pepper balls into the crowd as demonstrators continue to flee. At around 7:05 p.m., I saw the president walking onto 8th Street from Lafayette Square near St. John's Church. The president's arrival was a complete surprise, as we had not been briefed that he would enter our sector. As for the new security barrier, whose installation was a stated purpose for the clearing operation, the materials to erect it did not arrive on scene on 8th Street until around 9 p.m. that evening, and it was not completed until later on. Members of the committee, the events I witnessed at Lafayette Square on the evening of June 1st were deeply disturbing to me and fellow National Guardsmen. Based on my training and experience, at no time did I feel threatened by the protesters or assess them to be violent. And based on established U.S. military protocols concerning proportionality of force and dealing with civil disturbances, both within the United States and overseas, it was my observation that the use of force against demonstrators in the clearing operation was an unnecessary escalation of the use of force. From my observation, those demonstrators, our fellow American citizens, were engaged in the peaceful expression of their First Amendment rights, yet they were subjected to an unprovoked escalation and excessive use of force.
And that's Major Adam DeMarco of the Washington, D.C. National Guard. But Federal Park Police head Gregory Monahan insisted he feared potentially violent protesters. Under questioning from Representative Ruben Gallegos, Monahan admitted only one officer was injured that day, though, and only after the Lafayette Park was cleared.
That day you only had one injury. What time was that injury at? You testified June 1st, one injury. What time was that injury at?
The injury on June 1st was during the clearing operation of H Street.
So that whole day was peaceful testimony until the clearing, and yet you decided that somehow there was going to be violence, so therefore you initiated something before 7 p.m. curfew.
No, so that's inaccurate. What I stated earlier was that we saw violence throughout the operational period.
I'm not asking that. I'm asking on June 1st.
Yes.
Let me give you an example. When I was in the Marine Corps and I had to clear all these cities, I had to react to what was happening that day. I may have gotten shot at, thrown at, tried to be mortared, IED, that should happen every day. The next day, I went out and patrolled like a professional. On June 1st, by your testimony, you had largely peaceful protesters up until the time you actually forcibly tried to move them. Your decision-making process should have been based on the ground and what was happening on that day.
All of our decisions on June 1st were based on an on-the-ground assessment of the level of violence that was directed at law enforcement.
But
my
not of
testimony
that day.
Today.
Not,
is,
but not of that day.
No, sir. That's inaccurate.
That is very unprofessional if you were actually telling me that you made decisions of June 1st, what to do June 1st, and you decided that that day required a level of escalation because later on one person would get injured once you start moving through the crowd.
So my testimony to you today is our operation on June 1st was solely based on an effort to de-escalate the violence.
But de-escalating the violence does not mean sending, you know, men swinging their batons and using pepper spray or CS gas, whatever you guys claimed it to be, 40 minutes prior to a curfew. It just doesn't make logical sense.
And as Federal Park Police Head Gregory Monahan being questioned by Congressman Ruben Gallegos. Meanwhile, Major DeMarco of the D.C. National Guard said he feels his career is at risk for speaking out, but it was something he had to do in the spirit of John Lewis.
As the late Representative John Lewis said, when you see something that is not right, not just, not fair, you have a moral obligation to say something, to do something. The oath I swore as a military officer to support and defend the United States Constitution is a bedrock guiding principle for me. It's the foundation of the trust safely placed in the armed forces by the American people. And it compels me to say something, to do something about what I witnessed on June 1st at Lafayette Square.
Major Adam DeMarco of the Washington, D.C. National Guard. Across the hall, Tennessee Democrat Steve Collins kept up the grilling of Attorney General Bill Barr, alleging the Department of Justice had been used as a political tool for the White House.
When did you first learn that the president planned to walk through the park and go to St. John's Church?
First, I'd like to respond to what you
said. Would you please answer my question? My time is limited.
I learned sometime in the afternoon that the president might come out of the White House, and then later in the afternoon I heard that he might go over to the church.
So it was absolutely necessary the park be cleared for his walk.
No, that had nothing to do with that. The plan to move
it was necessary that the park be cleared, and it was done, and you said get it done.
Well,
I have the time. Thank you. In Portland, we've seen mothers and we've seen veterans who were peacefully protesting, not threatening the federal courthouse, beaten and gassed. Unidentified armed federal agents violently attacked demonstrators in a violation of the First Amendment's freedom of assembly and arrested citizens without individualized suspicion in a violation of the Fourth Amendment's protection against unreasonable searches and seizures and a warrant requirement. You've gone through the Fifth Amendment and due process and just negated it. And the Tenth Amendment, which leaves general policing to the law enforcement, to the states, has been forgotten. Maybe what happened was your secret police were poorly trained, just like your Bureau of Prisons guards were poorly trained and allowed the most notorious inmate in our nation's last several years, Jeffrey Epstein, to conveniently commit suicide. Sad. You misled Congress and the American people about Special Counsel Mueller's findings with your, quote, summary, unquote, of his report. In Michael Cohen, you've treated him differently than Michael Flynn and Roger Stone. In Michael Flynn, you've attempted to dismiss the charges, even after he twice pled guilty. And in Roger Stone, you went further. Mr. Barr, John Lewis said to us, if not me, who, if not now, when? That's why I introduced H.R.E.S. 1032, which would require this committee to investigate your conduct as Attorney General and determine whether you should be impeached.
House Judiciary Committee members Steve Collins and Attorney General William Barr on Tuesday. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Monday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced his priorities for the Senate COVID-19 and Economic Response Bill. It again excludes extra SNAP or food stamps funding passed by the House on May 15th. According to a poll by Hunger Free America, 37% of parents nationwide are cutting the size of meals or skipping meals for their children because they did not have enough money for food. The HEROES Act passed by the House provides a 15% increase in benefits for SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, program, formerly known as the food stamp program. The bill also includes a $150 million increase for funding to charitable food banks, soup kitchens, and food pantries, many of which are faith-based. But Hunger Free America CEO Joel Berg says the GOP is committed to helping the wealthy at the expense of poor children.
The Republicans want to extend the tax breaks for a three martini lunch, but they won't provide an extra penny of money for SNAP, what used to be called the food stamps program. They won't extend the PEBT program, which gives extra money for parents and kids in schools that are closed and they don't have school meals. It's as if they've hit the Titanic, and it's as if they're in the Titanic, they've hit an iceberg, and instead of bailing or getting the lifeboats, they're looking for other icebergs to hit.
Mm-hmm. And what is this going to mean for kids if this stands?
There's no question more people are going to go hungry in New York City and America if the Republicans don't reverse their position and stop opposing increases in food aid to hungry kids, to hungry working people, to hungry seniors. It's just really incredible. They want to lavish ever more corporate welfare on their wealthy friends and want to make everyone else starve.
Is this a continuation of things that are already happening or a new escalation in this battle?
Well, the Republican Party for the last few decades, ever since the Reagan era, has been hell-bent on dismantling the nutrition safety net and the rest of the anti-poverty safety net. But they were at least marginally, kind of, sort of, less antagonistic in previous recessions. This is really new, that in the greatest recession/depression since the 1930s, they are really actively still looking to gut these programs. So it's a continuation of what the Republican Party has been doing for decades, but really, like much else now, an escalation.
Yeah, what's driving this escalation, in your opinion?
The Republicans believe that they can con their so-called base into believing that this funding goes to the so-called other. In fact, out of the 10 states that get SNAP participation, in fact, out of the 10 states that have the highest rates of SNAP participation, 8 voted for Donald Trump in 2016. So it's just really ridiculous that they are shafting their own people. States like Kentucky, which Mitch McConnell represents, there are a lot of hungry people, but they're shafting their own people, and they think somehow their base would be happier if they're starving, just as long as the other people they don't like are getting food. An underpinning of this is race baiting. The Republicans always want to imply that this is non-white people, when the largest number of people who get SNAP are white. That's always been the case, that we, you know, still the case, but that's not what they want their supporters to think.
And that's Hunger Free America CEO Joel Berg. Berg adds, hungry people are prone to both contract and transmit COVID-19 and other diseases. Because junk food is usually cheaper than healthier food, food insecurity also increases the likelihood of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, asthma, and other conditions that, Berg adds, make it more probable that people will die from COVID-19 and other related ailments. And in New York City, Mayor de Blasio says the GOP COVID-19 bill will devastate New York and force the city to lay off thousands of workers.
This stimulus plan from the Republicans slashes unemployment benefits at a point where people need them more than ever. It ignores entirely the extent of the hunger crisis. We know right now in this city, almost 2 million New Yorkers need food at some point or another in the week, and we're providing food for free to all New Yorkers who need it. 100 million meals served so far for free. The Republican Senate plan just doesn't work. And it certainly fails places that have been hit hardest by the coronavirus, like New York City. So again, this plan will not work. It is a non-starter. It literally misses the opportunity to help us fight back, fight this disease, restart our economy. This plan will not help us do that, and we need to see something much better. Once again, the President of the United States remains silent on the topic. We need to fight for a much better, much clearer stimulus. And in the end, think about it now. Think about the first responders, the healthcare heroes. Think about the teachers. Think about the sanitation workers, all the people we depend on who right now don't know if they're going to have their jobs in the future. The very people who fought through this crisis and saved us, don't know what the future looks like, not only here, but all over the country. And there is no new revenue coming. So unless this stimulus happens in Washington on the level we need it to, we won't be able to save the jobs that deserve to be saved. We won't be able to restart our economy. The analogy that I would say is this is like the Republicans in the Senate saying they have a fire truck and they go to a burning building and they park the fire truck in front of the burning building, but they refuse to hook up the hose and put out the fire. That's what this plan says to us. It says they aren't interested in actually solving the problem.
Mayor de Blasio. In his briefing, the mayor touched on a lawsuit by the police union blocking the release of disciplinary records for thousands of NYPD officers. New York City recently repealed 50A, a law shielding the cops' records from public scrutiny. The New York Civil Liberties Union was barred from releasing its copies of the files by a judge, but it turned out the files for thousands of officers obtained by news agency ProPublica escaped the judge's gag order. Eric Umansky is deputy managing editor of ProPublica.
What we have is what amounts to a kind of card catalog or an index of complaints against officers. We don't have the details of each complaint against them. So it will say Officer Joe Smith alleged conduct. It'll have literally just a few words that'll say something like physical force, or in some cases, gun as club, or offensive language. Then it'll have some further details just about the time, the precinct where the officer was or is, and the ultimate disposition of the case as the CCRB found it. And that is what we put out. In order to really look at sort of bigger trends or more detail into cases, we need the underlying details. Having said that, sort of top line thing you can see is that the vast majority of NYPD officers have not had a significant number of complaints against them. 40-something percent have had no complaints against them. Another 20-something percent have had just one complaint against them. And that number keeps going down until you get to about six cases, in which case about 9% of officers, it's hundreds of officers, have had many complaints against them. Then you can begin to see trends with those officers. You see officers who have had repeated physical force complaints. You see officers who've had many, many complaints, and as it happens, few substantiations, which is the CCRB wasn't able to tell what happened, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen. And in fact, the patterns you can see begin to suggest that there may be a problem. When it comes to investigating the police and this thing called the CCRB, it's important to understand that the CCRB actually in the real world has very limited and constrained investigative powers. They have to ask the NYPD to share any records, whether it's body-worn camera footage, whether it's records of arrests. And the NYPD can, and indeed often does, simply decline to share that evidence, at which point the CCRB investigators have no real ability to figure out the underlying facts of the case. The reason it works that way is because unions have argued against granting the CCRB authority for years. It also, in order for a case to be substantiated, it's not simply an investigator's conclusion. It has to be voted by, to be substantiated by the board of the CCRB. Well, who is on the board of the CCRB? It's in part civilians and also representatives of the police commissioner. It is exceedingly difficult in the way that it works now and exceedingly rare for cases to be substantiated. There were about 3,000 complaints against the NYPD specifically about use of force. Of those 3,000 complaints, there were 73 that were ultimately substantiated. And of those, the number of officers who got significant discipline, or the most significant discipline, was 9. Those officers, the most significant discipline they were given was lost vacation days. That is the system of justice that you're talking about now. The other thing to understand is that we, even given all of that, still haven't published all the data. We only published complaints against officers who've had, even in this, excuse my Yiddish, verkackte system, have only had at least one case substantiated against them. And of the complaints that we include, even with that limitation, we only include complaints that the CCRB declared that it was able to more fully investigate, which includes, critically, that a complainant didn't just file a complaint, mm-hmm. that they did a follow-up interview, and that they gave a sworn statement.
Eric Umansky is deputy managing editor of ProPublica. And finally, the Wall of Moms, seen stepping up to defend black and brown protesters in Portland, are now popping up around the country with at least 22 new chapters organizing in different cities and states. In addition to their presence on the streets, they're also taking the fight to the court. The Portland Wall of Moms, WOM, joined the black-led Don't Shoot Portland and other plaintiffs to sue the Trump administration on Monday to try and stop federal agents from using excessive force against protesters. According to the lawsuit, plaintiff Bev Barnum, a resident of Portland, Oregon, organized the Wall of Moms in mid-July to join ongoing Black Lives Matter protests in the city. They joined protesters on the July 18th and 19th weekend when federal agents cracked down harshly on demonstrators using tear gas and other aggressive methods to suppress the protests. Other cities where chapters have formed include Seattle, Kansas City, Denver, Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, and Milwaukee, as well as regions of New Jersey. And that's some of the news for July 28th, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News from New York, I'm Paul D'Arienzo. Thanks for listening.